All right. Good morning. I really appreciated Earl's songs this morning. I'd just like you to turn back to page number 699, the song he had us sing. I don't know about you, but I can oftentimes sing a song and not really be thinking about the message. And I guess, you know, by the fact that I was going to bring the message here this morning, this song really meant a lot to me. But I just like to read the song. It says, Lord, I am fondly, earnestly longing into thy holy likeness to grow, thirsting for more and deeper communion, earning thy love more fully to know. Dead to the world would I be, O Father, dead unto sin and live unto thee, and live unto thee. Crucify all the earthly within me, empty of sin and self may I be. I would be thine and serve thee forever, filled with thy spirit and lost in thy love. Come to my heart, Lord, come with anointing, showers of grace send down from above. So if you sang that and really meant it, by the way, sorry for all the stickers. There's a lot of weird things that happened before in studying this message. So I'm going through the book of James as an anchor for my messages, and I guess the reason why I value James so much is because of his candid, he's such a candid person. And I also know that that's the reason why he had camel knees and he was killed. So I think if James was here today, he'd be killed. So I named the series of James, I named it Self-Preservation or Self-Sacrifice. And I kind of was studying James 4. You can turn there a while. I was studying James 4, and I thought, you know what? I can skip over this chapter, and you'll never know it. and I'll just go to chapter 5, because people actually remember about a tenth of what you say, and that's usually for 3 months, and then they forget it. And I could probably prove that this morning. They ask you where I've been speaking out of, but it's just the foolishness of preaching, and it's just the way it's always going to be. We're leaky vessels. So I just named this, What is Motivating You? And there's 5 different topics that James kind of touches on, and the first one is greed and covetousness. That's verse 1 and 3, and then friendship with the world is verses 4 and 5. And that 4 to 5. And then our redemption from that is verses 6 to 10. And then judging others is 11 to 12. And then what's God's plan for your life, which is 13 to 17. Now, if you know me, I could make a message out of verses 13 to 17. That's a topic I'm pretty passionate about. The other ones I'm not real passionate about, I'll be honest. And it's not, it was, I have a lot of opinions about these verses, but they mainly apply to myself. So if you feel pressure, you know, there's a little saying, if you feel pressure, you're doing something wrong. So if you feel pressure and you want to relieve that pressure, just think about it from the that this is Lyndon's perspective, and then take it out on James, okay? So here we go. So this chapter felt very heavy to me, but then the more I studied it, the more I realized how relevant it is to the American Christian. You know, James just does not mince words. He does not beat around the bush. He just kind of like, it's out there. And there's not a whole lot of wonder what he's saying. You know, some other scriptures take a lot of thought and processing to understand it, but, you know, this chapter is so relevant for where our churches are losing ground, and why they're rendered ineffective today. And the irony of that is our children know. Our children know why we're losing effectiveness. They know why we're dealing with what we're doing. And some of them are just spinning off. And then they want nothing to do with this, what we call this conservative lifestyle. But I'm actually fired up about our youth because I really think that they're worth fighting for and that they're going to make a great difference in eternity because of what God's going to give them in this distracted world. So I really appreciated the opening this morning and how relevant that was to where we are today. All right, with that, I'm going to read James 4. It's not a long chapter. It says, "From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust, and ye have not. Ye kill, and desire to have, and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you have not, because you ask not. You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may consume it on your own lusts. You idolaters and idolatresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is an enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is an enemy of God. Do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy? But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but he giveth grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners. Ye purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. You that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin." So, when feelings of frustration and anger flare up inside of you, do you ever ask where they come from? You know, it doesn't come from those that we want to blame. It actually comes from inside our heart and the reality and the condition of our heart. What James is addressing here in the opening of this chapter is how that we can become, that monster can damn us. He uses strong language, and we could dismiss what he is saying, and oftentimes we'll dismiss someone with strong language, but that again only confirms that we don't believe what the scriptures from God. So James just comes ripping right out here in the beginning. And he said, there in verse 1, he says, what is causing the quarrels and fight among you? Don't you come from the evil desires that are inside of you? You know, what does cause drama in our churches and our families? Then he goes right into, It's interesting to me, before we address someone's complaints and issues, do we ever ask them if they're willing to be part of the solution? That's always really telling to me. You know, when someone brings something that they're offended from about what somebody else is doing, but they don't want to be part of the solution. But I can always tell you whether it's worth your time and energy, and that is if they're willing to go with you and resolve it. So next time someone comes to you on an issue that they have about someone, just say, well, I'm glad to go with you and talk to them about it. And their response to that will tell you whether it's worth your while. And then just go back and read James 4 and get clear on what you should be doing. So I think you kind of can, James started here by naming some core issues, and I don't really think we actually resolve issues unless we're willing to identify the core issues. So if we, otherwise we just live in the peripheral. And if we are only willing, if that's where we want to live, the problems normally don't get solved and the drama doesn't go away. So the question I think you always need to ask yourself is, what are the hard questions you're avoiding? And if you're, you know, if, before we, if we're not willing to have those hard conversations, all we do is we maintain a perception of peace. It's not really a genuine peace. It's just that no one is challenging each other. And when you really think about that, what's the depth of that kind of a relationship, and what kind of a church will that create? You know, are we calling sin sin? Do we know what sin is? You know, are we dealing with the real motivation behind the issues we're dealing with? Or do we just love spiritualizing stuff and as a way for us to defend our position? You know, in family dynamics, it's much easier to identify in some ways, but it often becomes very obvious when parents pass away, if the children were left with an inheritance, it's the true dynamics of that family shows up pretty quick. In contrast to when the parents don't have much and they don't have much to lose, it just really lowers the potential for a negative impact on the family. It also shows the parents the values the parents lived out, and it often shows up in their children in times like that, you know, what the parents live for. All right, then in verse 2, we come back up to verse 2, and it says, you want what you don't have, so you scheme and you kill to get it. You are jealous or what others have, but you can't get it, so you fight and you wage war and you take it away from them, yet you don't have what you want because you don't ask God for it. I think the key there is we don't ask God for it, we don't pray about things, but and I think if we'd pray about things more, we'd probably get a better perception of God's heart. But verse 2 here again, it says, can I dismiss it? You know, I really don't think you can dismiss this verse, because James is addressing the causes of contention here, where he in his the environment where he was dealing with. But our motivations, are they evil desires? And at some point, we have to get honest with ourselves about what our motivations are. So, wanting what we don't have, we call that contentment. You know, are we contented people? Our drive for personal pleasure. And when people get in the way of that, is that what triggers us? You know, my question is, are we dealing with either of these in American churches, and why? And do we think either of these may be contributing to our churches and what they're facing in this economy? The tendency for jealousy and greed is just escalates when there's more. You know, the less you have, the less that is that drive there is there. Then he goes in and talks about greed. And Tyler, would you put up that first slide just to anchor this? Because it might be a little bit hard for us to, you don't have to dim the lights. I think they can read it. So the difference between the greed surfaces in two things from my perspective. It's permissiveness and covetousness, okay? So just to get clear on what permissiveness is, it relates to what we have. okay? So have you ever thought about the more people have, the more they justify their lifestyle? Watch it. The more people have, the more they justify their lifestyle, and they say, I earned this, I deserve this. So that's so that relates to what we have. Covetousness relates to what we want, okay? And then the permissiveness is being selfish with what you own, not quick to share, accumulating for ourselves for personal pleasure. And then to covet is to long for or be preoccupied with having what God hasn't given us, okay? Remember the whole thing about if we'd pray for it, maybe God would say no? No to that. Is it also the passion to possess what others have and what others don't? It drives us to keep up with others, okay? If they have it, we justify that we could have it too. So, done with the slide. So turn with me to Colossians 3:5, okay? So this is serious business, this thing of covetousness and jealousy. And we may want to dismiss it and say, well, maybe that was, you know, James was talking pretty strong back in that, you know, he was talking about killing people. Well, the good news is we as Anabaptists got that off the table because we made that unpopular to kill each other. So, but the bad news is we have other ways of doing it. So Colossians 3:5 says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. Now listen to the sins that he's naming here. And think about how gross these sins are. And it's fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, which lust for unrighteous desires, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Okay? So are we thinking about covetousness as being idolatry? I mean, you're idolizing something that somebody else has that you don't have, and that's put in there as, all that is put in there as idolatry. So going into verse 2, it says, talks about that, and so we say, well, we are not killing each other, but we certainly would be okay with gossiping that will kill somebody else's reputation. And a little bit of jealousy is probably a good thing to do if it motivates you to do more, I guess. And we certainly don't do that fighting and waging war stuff, but what do we do? So another, I guess one way that I kind of think of things, I like to put things into a perspective so I can measure it, okay? I guess that's kind of a default for me. So like I told the intermediate class this morning, if we want to measure our love for God, it's easy, right? All we think about is the most undesirable person we can think about, and we think about how much love we have for him. That's our love for God. Because we're supposed to love our enemies, right? So the most undesirable person you can think of right now and how you feel about them is your love for God. So here's one, all right? Who are your peers? Think about that, all right? Now, what do you want that your peers have? And I want to tell you, we often look at youth as being the time of our life where peers have the most impact, but not in America. I told the youth they have a disadvantage. I'm using my youth class here, a little bit, other intermediate class, but I told them, I said, you guys are about to enter the most challenging time of your life because your peers are going to have the biggest effect on you. And our peers, that age between 20 and 30 is very... Our peers have such an impact. When we get to in our 30s, it's about our success. How are we going to define success in our life, and what does that look like? That drives us to our career, what we're going to do with our career, and that type of thing. And then, oftentimes, our peers will define what success looks like for us. I really would challenge you on this, and that is, you know, those of you like me that like to post stuff, just think about what you're communicating by what you post, okay? So, you know, just think about that. So the next section we're going to move into is friendship with the world. And when I started going down through this, I changed my notes so many times. I didn't want to do this one because I think it's the one that hits me the worst. You know, it's strong language here, but he said, those that will be the friends of the world are idolaters and idolaters. That is harsh. So we have to define what friendship with the world looks like. And, you know, I think we tried to do that in our agreements as for members here. So that's kind of like the baseline. But if we're not taking it above that baseline, we're going to be friends with the world. You know, I can imagine that they wanted to shut James down on this one and discount everything he was saying in this next part. But is this why we are not facing persecution today? Can we imagine someone preaching like this today? And again, I'm just glad I can blame James for saying this because I think he would pin me against the wall. Are we not calling sin out in our churches? Are we looking the other way so that we don't see the wickedness around us to preserve our little worlds of pleasure and self-fulfillment? Story that was happened recently in one of our churches where there was child abuse. It made me so sick. I don't know, there's something about an adult abusing a child that I just want to strangle. But I think the only way to get over that is to realize that the offender faced something in their life that we may know nothing about. And until we can start loving the offender, we're not going to wind up at a very good place. Verse 4. You idolaters, I guess I should be shouting that, it's with an exclamation mark. Do you realize that the friendship with the world makes you an enemy with God? I say it again. If you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy with God. Do you think the scriptures have no meaning? God is passionate that the spirit he has placed within us should be faithful to him. You know, idolatry, I hope, puts a really strong feeling in your heart. You know, it's lusting after something that is not ours. It robs us of a relationship with God. Just like lusting, if you're a married person and you're lusting after someone other than your spouse. I think it's okay to lust after her or him. But what would you label friendship of the world from your perspective? I'll take that back. I guess that's not. So, you know, this will trigger, this is going to trigger some of you. And I apologize. But I couldn't get down through this without thinking about the practical side of this. And I feel like I'd do you a disfavor if I didn't talk about it. So, Do I have your permission to say something this morning? It's not really fun. So who are you following? Who has control over you? Do you think about that? When you make decisions in your life, do you think about when you go to make that decision? Do you think about making that decision about how people are going to think? But more importantly is, are you making that decision based on how people are going to think about you? Or are you making that decision based on how people are going to think about Christ? So I have a question, which is more important to you? Have any of you guys watched Anabaptist Perspectives, the latest one by Pat Matthews? Did anybody watch that? All right. I would encourage you to listen to that. It was interesting to me. Pat Matthews is a good friend of mine, and he has shared some of his frustrations in a very strong way, as Pat does. And he has been extremely frustrated with our culture. But do you know what keeps him here? So I'll let you listen to it and hear it, but I'll just tell you one thing that keeps him here. It's what we have in community. You know, he could go to a lot of other, he has friends in a lot of different other churches, but he stays with the Anabaptist people because he has decided to call them his people. And the reason why he calls them his people is he's never experienced community like he's been with them. Well, there's things that create our community, but one of the things that create our community is what we give up. So you can measure the health of a community, you can measure the value of a community by how much they'll give up. So do you know what the Bloods, do you know what they give up so that they can, they give up their fear of death. They're going to kill somebody to get in that community. So do you think they have a, what kind of community do they have? It's a fear community. So they drive that fear that we could kill you too, you killed somebody. So the loyalty to that community is a fear loyalty. So what is our loyalty? Okay. So the more that we're willing to give up that's rightfully ours, and then we can use the Bible to defend it and all those other things, the willingness to give that up to be in a community is going to give us more community. Does that make sense? That's kind of a preface of what I'm going to say. So who are you following? Who is influencing you? All right. Well, I will tell you, though, if our applications and our choices aren't anchored in principle, we will drift, okay? If our applications here at Joy are not anchored in godly principle, we will drift, okay? That's the natural bent of human beings. If you're not paddling, you're drifting, okay? So it takes active work and hard work to stay paddle upstream. And I want to tell you, we live in a river. We don't live in a stream here. If you go out in the boonies, maybe you're in a stream, but we live in the river here, okay? And I lovingly call it the swamp. So I would just say that this is more of a challenge for us because of what we have to deal with, okay? So here's the part that you can just write off as my perspective, but this is what I'd like to ask you. So, you know, for men, we deal with hairstyles and designer clothing and that kind of stuff because of our desire to impress or depress other people. Women get really hit, okay? I know this. My wife spends a lot of time explaining that to me. But, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but mini skirts are back, okay? What's always interesting to me is that we never go to that extreme, do we, okay? But it wasn't that long ago till, you know, dresses to your ankles were in. But the question I have is, if that's the world's new fashion, how long does it take for the church to start reacting to that? Okay? And that's... the question is, who's behind the world's fashion? Okay? Have you ever looked who's behind the world fashion? Who actually is invested in the world's fashion? Who is paying for the runway? Do you know what the runway is? I'm glad you don't. But there is a runway where people display the fashion, and that's where the fashion gets caught. And then there's all kinds of versions of the runway. But women's dresses are the predominant thing on that runway, okay? And then people get frustrated about talking about it, but even the world knows that that's the number one focal point. So if the world's dresses are going up and our dresses are going up, well, the question I have for you is, what made you make that choice, okay? If it's to be more modest, well, then stand on your head, I guess. You know, the one that kind of gets me in the gut is the one that says everybody's doing it. I mean, who cares? I mean, that's an awesome statement if it's a new fad that's a better application of God's principle, okay? But if it's not, and then it's not a cool thing to say. So, but why would we change if a new fad is less applicable to a godly principle of modesty? That's the question I'd like to leave with you. I mean, the one I like best, obviously, is it's cheaper and more practical. Now, that one there is really good. You know, so when was a Christian life more practical? You know, when was it cheaper or easier? You know, are we buying into the lies that started back in the garden? So which comes first, practical or godly? Well, I think they're equally important, but godly comes first, okay? Practical is a good thing. These are all good things, but the question is, what comes first? We can... is this too heavy? I get accused of... you wouldn't want to see me on stage somewhere else. I only keep to my notes so I stay on track. Otherwise, I'd be all over the place. When I go talk to groups, I don't use notes. But it gets pretty random. You know, the sad part is we've taken this into ministry and into our evangelism. We put efficiency before effectiveness in ministry. See, we're really good stewards. We really take good care of God's things. But we put efficiency. So how efficient is it to stop along the road and talk to a beggar or giving money or whatever? How efficient is that? So if you use efficiency, which we have, we really limit our evangelism. But, you know, that's not happening in Asia. they're giving everything to share the gospel, even their lives. And we as Americans, we pack up and we go home when little things get rough. And I'm not saying they shouldn't, but, you know, what's most important in God's eyes? And this is to me, I'm not talking to you. When you compare our desires to follow the world's fashions and fads, and when you see that as idolatry and idolaters in God's sight, it can really feel harsh, but that's God's comparison, not mine. So we're going to move into the next part. That stuff's heavy, but to me, but you know, what are we not navigating well, and what's our redemption? So here's the good news. Verse 6, he says, he gives grace generously. As the scriptures say, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So humble yourselves before God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So why aren't the churches healthy today? They aren't resisting the devil. That's what it's clear. The lack of health is the lack of humility. Okay? The interesting thing is they all want to talk about grace, but how much do you hear about humility? There's a condition for the grace. The more grace you have, the more humble you are, the more grace you get, right? But you don't hear a whole lot of talk about humility. You hear a lot more talk about grace, and it'd be a lot more fun to give a message up here about grace than it is about humility. It is interesting to me that he follows the friendship with the world and talking about grace, all right? So we're looking for grace from others to follow the world. Did you ever think about that? People want grace. They want grace so they can follow the world. But if we want grace from God, it's conditional. It's only as much as we'll humble ourselves. So, in my mind, grace and humility are synonymous. Humility is a prerequisite of grace. And the more humble that you are, the more grace you are given. So think about that. We treat others the same way that we want to be treated, but think about it from a standpoint that God's love for us and his grace toward us is in proportion to our humility. Do you know how often that God's hatred for pride and arrogance is mentioned in the Bible? I don't know exactly, but it's over 200 times. God's hatred for pride and arrogance. Then we go into verse 8, and it says, "Come close to God, and God will come close to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, purify your hearts, for your loyalty is divided between God and the world. Let there be tears for what you have done. Let there be sorrow and deep grief. Let there be sadness instead of laughter and gloom instead of joy. Humble yourselves," again, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up in honor. So it's our move. Here James gives God's definition of humility. He ends with humility as our only salvation from idolatry and adultery in this world. And then we move into judging others. And the last part, next to the last part there, he says, we need to give grace for those that have been given grace, and we want God to continue to give us grace, so we give grace to others. But then in verse 11, he speaks and says, don't speak evil against each other, dear brothers and sisters. If you criticize and judge each other, then you are criticizing and judging God's law. That's an interesting way to look at it. But your job is to obey the law, not to judge whether it applies to you. God alone, who gave you the law, is the judge. He alone has the power to save and destroy. So what right do you have to judge your neighbor? So here he gives us four things: criticism against God, and here's another tension, grace and criticism. There's so many tensions in the Bible, but that tension of grace and criticism, there's something in the middle, okay? You don't want to criticize and you want to have grace. What's in the middle? How do you get to the middle of those two extremes, you may say? Grace, I don't think you can have enough grace for people, but you don't want to go to that other side, which is critical. But there is a part that we all have to face, and that is if we are not adhering to the agreements of a group, we need to go somewhere we can so that that grace can be authentic and functional. So I thought Jesus came to do away with the law. We don't have time to talk about that, but it'd be interesting to have a conversation around the aspect of the law here and obedience over justification. So are you beginning to understand why James was hated? He had no fear delivering truth, and we will experience the same hatred when we have the courage to speak the truth as he did. You know, maybe it's a way you might be feeling about me today in some of this, but, you know, this is my interpretation and my perspectives, and I may be wrong, but I'd be delighted to understand your perspective. But, you know, now we're coming to the end. This is the fun part for me. God has a plan for your life. And what is life all about anyway? Verse 13, look here, you who say, today and tomorrow we are going to a certain town and we will stay there a year. We will do business there. We will make a profit. How do you know that your life will be like tomorrow? Your life is like a morning fog. It's there a little while and then it's gone. What you ought to say is, if the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or that. Otherwise, we are boasting about our own pretentious plans, or such boasting is evil. Remember, it is sin to know what you ought to do and then do it not. So is it wrong to plan? No, in fact, that's our part. Proverbs 16 says, you plan, and I'll determine the increase. But your job is to plan. So I'm a big planner. I like plans. I believe a bad plan's better than no plan. At least you can change the plan, right? But it gets you moving. All right? So what are our motives behind our plans? Okay? How many people have you said, I want to make a million and then do mission work? You guys ever hear that? I've heard that from several men. Oh, wow, I just want to make, you know, well, in this world it's probably 2 or 3 million, but I just want to make this amount of money and then I'm going to do mission work. I have a question for you. How many of those people do you think stop at a million? I work with a lot of men that will confess to me that they thought they set a goal, but they didn't keep it. You know, God always honors our commitments if we keep them. And we limit his blessing when we don't. Randy Alcorn, it was already mentioned today. It's interesting. I mentioned him too, but there's several books back there on Randy Alcorn as it has to do with our money. But he's one of my favorite authors. He's authored several different ones. You might have heard the one on heaven. That was a good one too. But Randy Alcorn said that with hundreds of people he has engaged on this topic, and he has, those that gave little when they had little, a miserable few increased the percentage when they became wealthy. So here again, it goes back to the first part of James, and that's what's consuming you, what owns you, who is controlling you, who is controlling your decision. You know, one of my beliefs about what I do, which is coaching, is I believe one of my definitions of coaching is helping leaders discover or create better decision-making process so they can have better conversations with themselves, so they can have more meaningful conversations with others. All right? If you don't have a good decision-making process, we will stray. All right, verse 17, it says, what are we saying no to in exchange for what we're saying yes to? So in closing, I'm just going to read this story that we all know. And this is the first story that comes to many of our minds, I believe. It's a story about a man living out the American dream. He was an awesome businessman. He knew how to leverage his wealth. He was a great investor. It was all good until it owned him. So with all of us, there's a tipping point. Did you know that? At some point, something in life will own you if you don't surrender it. Okay? And the big one is money. It just is. It's the one thing that defines our lifestyle. It defines, for a lot of people, their happiness. It defines, but if we don't allow that to define us, people will see it. Well, this defined this man. It was his identity. It was his goal. He was going to retire early and enjoy life. And one man said to Jesus, Master, speak to my brother that he will divide the inheritance with me. And he said unto him, Man, who made me judge or divider over you? And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consists not of the abundance of the things that he possesses. And he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentiful. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room for to bestow my fruits, he said, I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, be merry. But God said unto him, you fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up a treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. He says unto his disciples, therefore I say unto you, take no heed for your life, what you shall eat, neither for your body, for what you shall put on. The life is more than meat, and the body is more than raiment. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which neither have a storehouse nor barn, and God feedeth them. How much more are ye better than them? What's your faith? And which of you, with taking a thought, can add his stature one cubit? If then be not able to do the things which is least, why take ye thought of the rest? Consider the lilies and how they grow. They toil not, they spin not, yet I say unto you that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of those. And we have Ecclesiastes to explain that. If then God clothe the grass, which is today in the field, and tomorrow he casts it in the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O ye of little faith? And then he says, and seek not what ye shall eat and what ye shall drink, neither be of doubtful mind. For all these things do the nations of the world seek after. That world, friendship with the world. And your Father knoweth that you have need of these things, but rather seek the kingdom of God, and all these other things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you this kingdom. Sell that you have, give alms, provide yourselves bags that wax not old, a treasure in heaven that will fail not, where no thief approacheth, no moth corrupteth. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Look where a man spends his money, you're going to know where his heart is. Let your loins be girded up, and your lights burning, and ye yourselves like unto men that wait for the Lord when he will return from the wedding, that he will cometh and knocketh, and he come and knocketh, and they may open unto him immediately. Blessed are those servants who the Lord then cometh shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, that he shall gird himself and make them sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and findeth them so, blessed are those servants. And this knows that if the good man of the house had known that the hour of the thief would come, he would have watched, and not have suffered his house to be broken through. Be ye therefore ready, for the Son of Man cometh in an hour we know not. You know, materialism is going to define two things that God hates, and that's idolatry and adultery. It's the combination of both in God's sight. And, you know, Jesus speaks in Revelation about the coming of the great Babylon. And if you look that up and study it more, you'll understand more about that. So what's going to motivate you this week? What are you going to let motivate you this week? What are you going to let make your decisions this week? Who's going to make those decisions for you? I'm convinced that there's nothing that will bring more joy and peace to a man on earth than to know he's investing in what God has put in his hands for eternity. So what's in your hands? It don't have to be money. We have so much to give here. You know, God has just provided this simple solution to war against this idolatry and adultery. You know, you live for others, not yourself. It's that simple. Do you want to be a legend, or do you want to be a legacy? Do you ever think about that? Do you want to be a legend? Do you want to be known to be from being a legend, or do you want to be known to have left a legacy? To become a legend, It's all about what you accomplish. There's a lot of people that have monuments that have lost their families. There's a lot of I speak with a lot of very wealthy businessmen, and some of them have B's behind it instead of M's. And one man called me last week, and he just said, "Lyndon, money means nothing to me anymore." Why does it mean nothing? It's so easy for him to make. He said, "It means nothing." He said, "I've lost all what I want." He had become a legend. See, we lift up our legends. We put them in leadership because they're such good businessmen. But if you leave a legacy, you leave a legacy by what you accomplish, others accomplish because of you. Leaving a legacy is what other people accomplish because of you. All we have been given is a powerful opportunity to impact eternity. Keep that as your primary motive. Think about how, before you make that decision this week, ask yourself, will this impact eternity? And you'll be among the most happiest, secure, and rewarded people on the face of the earth.